The history of the solar system may be revealed by worlds only now being discovered. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds. I'm Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Since the first discovery of an extrasolar planet some 20 years ago, the field has rapidly grown, with new techniques and more powerful instrumentation appearing quickly. As of now, nearly 2,000 exoplanets have been confirmed, with thousands of additional candidates awaiting follow-up observations. While most such planets are discovered by indirect means, by their gravitational effect on their parent star, or their occultation of stellar light, for example, new sensitive instruments have allowed a few to be detected by directly imaging them. Stan Metchev is the Canada Research Chair in Extrasolar Planets at Western University, and part of a team of researchers who've discovered a new exoplanet around the star 51 Eridani. Observed by direct imaging, it's the faintest and coolest planet discovered by this technique. As you'll hear, its star system, though very young, has some structural similarities to our own, and the planet is estimated to be only twice as massive as Jupiter. The discovery was published in the journal Science. Western World's John Kissy spoke to Dr. Metchev from the site of the Gemini South Telescope in the Atacama Desert of Chile about how the discovery was made and what we can learn from it.
Thanks very much for talking to us today, Dr. Metchev. It's a real honor to have you here. Maybe you could start by explaining a little bit about your background and current position.
Thank you, John. It is a pleasure. I arrived at the University of Western Ontario 2 years ago in a Canada Research Chair position. I am a Canada Research Chair in extrasolar planets, so my research really focuses on discovering and characterizing planets around other stars.
You have an astrophysics background?
That's correct, yes. I obtained my PhD in astrophysics in 2005. That was at the California Institute of Technology in the city of Pasadena, which is a suburb of Los Angeles in California.
You specialize in extrasolar planets. Can you explain a little bit about what interested you there?
You're making me think of things that I have not considered in a long time. When I was starting my university education, the first extrasolar planet was discovered that same year. That was the year 1995. And I felt that the universe had opened a whole new direction of studying astrophysics. We could actually now hope to discover planetary systems like our own. The field of extrasolar planet astrophysics has made tremendous strides since then. As of today, there's more than 2,000 confirmed extrasolar planets in over 1,000 planetary systems. So we have really come into the age of comparative exoplanetology, if you will, where we can now actually really get an accurate context of where our own planetary system, the planetary system around the Sun with the Earth, around it, fits in the universe. Part of what is really interesting about astrophysics is that there's so much we do not know about the universe. And exoplanets offered an excellent opportunity to go in a completely new direction. The long-term goal here in about 10 to 20 years is to not just find planetary systems like our own, but perhaps in fact find habitable planetary systems and maybe life elsewhere. That will be that's the dream, I think, of a lot of astrophysicists in this generation.
You're speaking to us today because you've got a new publication coming out. Maybe you could explain a little bit about what that publication is about and what the ramifications of it are.
I would be very happy to. So one of the most exciting, in my opinion, ways to look for extrasolar planets is to actually try to see them directly. That that's a very difficult thing to do because the planets themselves can be millions to billion times fainter than their stars. And at the very large distances at which these stars reside from the sun, the planets will appear very close to the star on the sky. So we need a very special tool, a high contrast imaging instrument on a very large telescope to be able to see the faint light from a planet and to discern it from the very bright light of its host star. So this technique called direct imaging is relatively new. It has only discovered about half a dozen, maybe up to 10 planets so far, and compare that to about 2,000 or so planets that are discovered through indirect techniques, where we actually do not see the planet directly. What the direct imaging technique gives us is the ability to actually see the surface or the atmosphere of the planet, so we can then in fact, take a spectrum, resolve the light of the planet in its constituent wavelengths, and study the chemical composition of the atmosphere. So that's how we would actually find things like water or oxygen or methane in the atmospheres of these planets. So that's what direct imaging gives us. And about a year ago, in fact, 2 years ago at this point, a large international collaboration called the Gemini Planet Imager Extrasolar Planet Survey commissioned this very novel extreme contrast imaging instrument on one of the largest telescopes on the ground, one which Canada has access to as well. That's the Gemini South Telescope in Chile. So we started using this instrument to conduct a survey of the nearest and youngest planetary systems, or stars, I should say, nearest and youngest stars, hoping to find planetary systems that are young. And when they're young, the planets actually tend to be quite a bit brighter. So instead of having to look for planets that are a billion times fainter than their star, we're looking for planets that are just about a million times fainter than their star. And so this paper that's coming out in the Journal of Science, in fact, reports our first discovery of a planet around a nearby star. It's very exciting because this is, in fact, the coldest planet that has been discovered with this technique so far, which bespeaks the sensitivity that this new instrument that we're using has and the advantage it has over any of the previous instruments that have been used for direct imaging of extrasolar planets.
That's really exciting. So this is the first planet discovered with this particular instrument.
That's correct. And we currently have one of the two most sensitive instruments in the world to do this. So we're in friendly competition with another team in Europe. We got our first planet discovery first, so we're excited about that.
Of course, yeah.
But we certainly expect many more to come over the next couple of years.
Now, you mentioned direct imaging versus other kinds of planet detection. Can you give a little bit of detail about the way that the direct imaging methodology works?
Sure, yeah. So, let's see. Direct imaging is tough. That's the one way to start describing this. Again, because you have to get to this sort of millionth or billionth of the photons that come from the planet as opposed to the star. And what makes it extra hard is that when you're looking at these nearby stars from the surface of the Earth, you have to look through our own atmosphere. And as you well know, stars twinkle when you look at them at night. And that twinkling, what it does to your astronomical images, is that it actually smears the brightness of the star over some part of your detector. And that part is actually also where you would expect the extrasolar planets to be around that star. So if you cannot get rid of that twinkling, you have no chance of detecting the planets. So what direct imaging does is it uses a very neat technique called adaptive optics. And in essence, what adaptive optics do is that they actually control in real time the surface of a mirror inside a telescope. In a way such that it can actually undo the effect of the turbulence in the Earth's atmosphere and so remove the twinkling of the star. So when we actually remove the twinkling of the star, instead of it being smeared over a large part of our astronomical CCD detector, the light of the star gets concentrated in a small dot, and so does the light of the planet next to it. But now because we have much less contamination from the bright star, we have a much better chance of seeing the planet next to it. Now, this is really a very difficult thing to do because to eliminate the turbulence of the atmosphere, we can't really eliminate it 100%. We hope to get close to 100%, maybe 90-95%. But we have to do these corrections on the shape of that mirror very quickly. So our system, for example, measures and applies corrections 1,000 times a second, which is really fast. I mean, you need nearly supercomputer capability to be able to do this in real time. And with the new generation of even larger telescopes, in fact, you will absolutely need supercomputer capability to be able to do this in real time.
So you're using an adaptive optics coronagraph?
That's correct, yeah. So the adaptive optics system is just one bit of this. So you still have the bright starlight in your detector after that. And another neat component of this instrument that we're using, called the Gemini Planet Imager, is that we actually put the star behind a dark spot. So that's the way we actually try to then eliminate even more of the starlight contamination. And the planet would be somewhere next to the dark spot. So the star would be behind the spot, most of its light would be eliminated, and the planet light would all come through. So then we actually have an even better chance of seeing the planet. So this is really the essence of direct imaging. You try to eliminate as much as possible the light from the star and enhance the light from the planet in the resulting image.
Can you give us a top-level kind of idea about the kind of resolution that we're talking about?
That's a very good question. So we're trying to detect effectively planets on solar system scales around other stars. The problem is that the stars tend to be far. Even if I call them nearby, we're talking about stars that are tens or hundreds of light years away. So in astronomy, we speak in terms of angular resolution, but maybe to in fact bring it in context of the solar system, we're talking about resolutions that are of order of several astronomical units. So we cannot actually quite get as close to the stars as the Earth to the Sun is right now. The Earth is one astronomical unit from the Sun. That's the definition of an astronomical unit. All we can hope to detect are planets that are a few astronomical units away from their host stars. So in this particular case, the discovery is of a giant planet that's 13 astronomical units away from its star. Compare this to planets in the solar system. Jupiter is at 5 astronomical units. Saturn is at almost twice that distance. So we are detecting planets that are comparable in separation to giant planets separations from the Sun and our own solar system.
Is that helping you to further understand the formation of our solar system?
Yeah, that's exactly the idea, John. What is neat about this planetary system, or at least the planet plus star system that we found right now, is that an earlier study that my team conducted on nearby stars found that this particular star also has an asteroid belt around it. And an independent study from another team using a different space telescope, we used one of NASA's space telescopes to discover the asteroid belt. A different space telescope called the Herschel Space Observatory discovered that this star also has a belt of comets much further away from the star, like the Sun does. The Sun has an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter and a cometary belt beyond the orbit of Neptune. The name of the cometary belt is the Kuiper Belt. That's where Pluto orbits. So this star, 51 Eridani, has an asteroid belt and a cometary belt. And the asteroid belt was discovered by my team, and the cometary belt was discovered by others. And now we've discovered this giant planet in between the two. So we're starting to reveal architecture that's actually very similar to what we have in our own solar system. And what is different here is that the planet is a little bit more massive, perhaps, than Jupiter. We've discovered the most massive planet in the system, and there may well be other planets. And also, this system is quite a bit younger than our own. The star is only about 20 million years of age. So we're really seeing a planetary system at its earliest stages. If there are terrestrial planets around the star, they're actually probably still forming. So we're seeing an analog of the solar system when the rocky planets in the interior were actually still forming.
You mentioned just now that the age of the solar system was young. How are you able to discern that? How do you know that it's a young solar system?
That's a very good question, too. There's people who make their careers on determining the ages of stars. In this particular case, what we relied on is the fact that this star, 51 Eridani, happens to be a member of a family of stars that appear to move through space together. Such sort of common motion among stars does not last for very long after the stars are born, because stars' motions will become affected by those of nearby older stars, or by things that we call giant molecular clouds in our galaxy, or by the spiral arms of our galaxy. So stellar motions will get dispersed fairly quickly over time, on the time scale of maybe 100 billion years or so. Now, compare this to the age of the solar system, 4.5 billion years, and you realize that the Sun itself does not really belong anymore to a family of stars that are moving through space together. But in this particular case, we know there's more than 24 stars that are moving through space together, and when we look at all these stars, and we look at their physical properties, and we compare them to what we know about models of the evolution of stars, we see that they all are about share about the same age of 20 million years or so. So that's how we know that this particular star is actually young.
Do you have any information on the star or the planets that you found?
Yeah, so the star is not quite like our own sun. It is a little bit more massive. It also has two other stellar companions much further away. So it's actually a triple star system, and those two companions are less massive than the Sun. So we have this one star, 51 Eridani, and then we have these two distant companions that are less massive than the Sun. And the planet we have discovered with the Gemini Planet Imager, 51 Eridani B, orbits the main star. So it's close to the main star, not to the companions. So it's actually an intricate dynamical system, if you will, of stars and a planet. As far as the planet itself goes, we have been able to infer that it's quite cold, only about 650 to 700 degrees Kelvin, which is still warm enough to melt lead, but it's really the coldest extrasolar planet that we have found so far in direct imaging. And because it is so cold, its atmosphere is very rich in water and in methane. So these are the kinds of gases that we hope to find in atmospheres of extrasolar planets. And in fact, in the future, if these gases were to be also found to coexist with things like oxygen in the atmosphere of a planet, we would be quite confident that that kind of planet may be habitable or even inhabited. But again, this is not the case for 51 Eri B.
Reading your paper, there was some mention of the composition of Jupiter as a comparison to the composition of Eri B. So can you explain a little bit about that comparison?
Yeah, so Jupiter in the solar system is really our standard when we're studying giant planets around other stars. And we know fairly well the composition of Jupiter. Jupiter is quite cold. It's only about 150 to 170 degrees Kelvin. Certainly below freezing. And because it's so cold, it has a very molecule-rich atmosphere, not just molecules, but also clouds as well. So we know it has ammonia and methane and things like ammonium hydrosulfide and water at greater depths and so forth. It has many cloud layers, which is why it actually looks so colorful. The different clouds made up of different chemicals will show up in different colors. So if you look through Jupiter, at Jupiter through a telescope, for example, like the telescope at our Cronin Observatory on campus, you'll see the bands of clouds on the planet, and you'll see they actually have different colors. So we know Jupiter fairly well, and we can use what we know about the composition of Jupiter's atmosphere to then infer what the composition of the planets of what the composition of the atmospheres of planets around other stars would be. So this is really how we have inferred that this particular planet, 51 Eridani B, that we have discovered, has also methane and water in its atmosphere. It's really by comparing our theoretical models to the atmosphere of Jupiter to be able to infer the composition of the planet that we have discovered.
Okay. I understand that you're not in Canada at the moment.
That's correct. I'm actually at the Gemini Telescope using the Gemini Planet Imager to find more planets.
Where is that located?
This is in Chile.
Chile.
High up in the Atacama Desert, where it's extremely dry and the skies are usually clear. That certainly helps. The dryness and the clearness helps us with not having many clouds. And that's really the main problem that you would have in an astronomical observatory. When it's cloudy, you can't observe, you can't find extrasolar planets.
So maybe you could explain a little bit about the composition of your team, and is it a situation where there are people always there making observations, or is it a somehow automated process?
Absolutely, yeah. So the team, the Gemini Planet Imager Exoplanet Survey Team, comprises about 24 institutions, universities in the U.S., in Canada, and in Chile, in fact. What we do is we observe about 30 nights, 20 to 30 nights a year. So on any of those nights, 4 to 5 members of the team will actually travel to Chile at a telescope and take data. So presently, Western Ontario graduate student Sebastian Brazone is here with me, and we are joined by the principal investigator of the project, Bruce McIntosh from Stanford University in California, and another postdoctoral researcher from University of Berkeley in California. And it's the four of us at present, spending 5 nights here taking observations. But come August, another team will come here for another 5 nights to take observations. As far as the process of discovery, we have at this point observed about a tenth of our entire sample of nearby stars that we wanted to scrutinize for planets. We have found one planet, and we actually have a few more candidates, which we still have to follow up with future observations. This particular discovery happened, in fact, in December last year, 2014. We got very excited about it because it was a very faint dot next to this bright star, and this usually is an indication that we actually may be seeing a planet. But just that one epoch of discovery is not sufficient. We have to be able to confirm that we can see the planet. So we have to follow this object up with observations later in January and February this year, and also at a different telescope. We also used the largest telescope in the world, the Keck Observatory Telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii, and that telescope confirmed the discovery. So then, with the discovery and the confirmation in hand, we were certain that we had a planet, and we went ahead, wrote the paper, and submitted it to the journal Science, and they have now accepted it.
So what sort of things are you looking at when you choose an area to turn this instrument on?
Yeah, so in fact, what we select more are the stars themselves, and they happen to be distributed all over the sky. So what we're looking for, the stars that we want to study, we want them to be very young, because giant planets are much brighter in young planetary systems. When a giant planet forms, when a gas giant planet forms like Jupiter, it will contract from what we call is the protoplanetary nebula. So the giant planet will contract from the gas in the planetary nebula, in the protoplanetary nebula, and when it contracts, it heats up initially. So it becomes hot. When it becomes hot, it is actually luminous. And then over time, it'll gradually cool and continue to contract slowly, but mostly cool at this point. So it'll be brightest at the initial stage when it is forming, and then the older it is, the cooler and the dimmer it is. So to find giant planets most efficiently around other solar systems, we would like to target the youngest solar systems that we can find. So the main task really is identifying the nearest and the youngest stars to the sun. And these can be anywhere in the sky. Then when we go to observe at a telescope at a certain time of the year, we cannot see the entire sky that would be accessible at any time of the year. We only see, say, the summer sky or the winter sky or the fall sky or the spring sky. So during the 5 nights that we're here in Chile, by the way, it happens to be winter here in the southern hemisphere, so we're seeing the winter southern sky. We can access a fraction of our sample that we have selected, fraction of the sample of young stars that we have selected, and these are the stars that we're now targeting with a telescope.
Okay, well, that sounds very exciting. So I suppose the next question is, if there are any students who are listening and interested in getting involved in this scientific area, what kind of skills would they require in order to be able to become part of this exoplanet finding community?
Well, that's a very good question, John. The kind of instrumentation that we used uses advanced computing, engineering, and optics technology. So any student with an engineering background can become involved in this. Ultimately, it will come down to actually studying physics, as tough as this may sound. But when you actually want to go into astronomy and study extrasolar planetary systems or galaxies in the universe or stars, you end up having to know about the physics of these objects. So one requires physics to be able to understand astrophysics. But our team does involve also computer scientists, engineers, optical engineers, and these various collaborators of ours will have had some brush with physics during their careers. But basically, if you want to do this, come to Western, take our physics courses, take some of our astronomy courses, and we'll tell you more about extrasolar planets.
Excellent. That sounds like a really interesting field to get into, and it sounds like it's going to be very exciting for the foreseeable future. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Metchev, for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure.
And good luck with the rest of your observations.
Thank you.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and featured an interview by co-host John Kissy. Our editors were John Kissy and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWCPSX, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can find world enough and time to join us again right here on Western Worlds.